copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
We are going to talk about Greek manuscripts. About Greek manuscripts that are bigger. And we're going to think about what can we learn from the Greek manuscripts. We know that there are differences between them. We know that there are differences in wording. But what sort of differences are that? How did they come into being? And what is our sort of knowledge about those things? And how disturbed should we be about all those differences? Let's think about the extensive evidence. So we're not talking about small fragments here, we're about talking about manuscripts where you can really learn something. This is one manuscript from the 3rd century, from the letters of Paul. And this goes on page after page, like that. Now this is text, you can do something with it. Now there is sufficient amount of text available to be really useful for studying the text of the New Testament. This one's called P46. Another one from the 3rd century, called P75, and goes on page after page, such as this. And again, here we have something real good early evidence in our hands. This gives us plenty of material to work with. But these two are either from the letters of Paul or from some of the Gospels, don't give us the whole of the New Testament. For that we have to wait one more century, go to the 4th century. And there we get this beauty of a manuscript, Codex Sinaiticus. Now we know that codex is the sort of book form, it's not a roll, but it's codex. It's called Sinaiticus because it was found on Mount Sinai and then brought to the West. Some would say it had been stolen to the West, but ended up in St. Petersburg for a while, and some parts are still St. Petersburg. Most of it is now in the British Library. It lived on my desk for a couple of months as well. That's good fun. But this is 4-column, the whole of the New Testament, not a single chapter missing. 4th century, good stuff. And goes on page after page, such as this. And then we have another one. This is Codex Vaticanus, Vatican, kept in the Vatican, probably from the 15th century onwards. Misses everything after Hebrews 9, roughly, because it just got lost. But most of the New Testament, and this is one of the most carefully copied manuscripts. And why can I say it's carefully copied? Because the scribe involved made so few blunders. When you're copying a text, you're going to make blunders. The scribe responsible for this one hardly made any. So its execution is very careful. And actually, its the text itself, especially of the Gospels, is of a very high quality. And goes on page after page like that. Then, century further, Codex Alexandrinus, also in the British Library, sort of on display, permanent display, nicely nestled next to Codex Sinaiticus. If you ever go to London, now you want to visit King's Cross Station, of course. I mean, that's where our childhood began, no, with Harry Potter and the whole thing, King's Cross Station. But 2 blocks further, sort of 200-300 yards away, is the British Library. You can just walk in and see these things on permanent display there. I mean, it's just there. You can see it. You can almost touch it. There's a bit of glass in between, but you can put your finger quite close to it. Goes on page after page, and Codex Alexandrinus is interesting because in the Gospels, it has the more or less liturgical text of the Gospels, and we're going to think about that difference a little bit later. But from Acts to Revelation, it has a very old text, a very good text, very original text, which is not affected by liturgy. So that's Codex Alexandrinus, and goes on page after page. Now we talked in earlier talk a little bit about numbers, and I want to revisit that a little bit. So this is the distribution of the manuscripts up to the year 750. Now this is just bare numbers of manuscripts. This is not an indication of how much text each of these manuscripts contains. So if we look at sort of, if we would look at content, so how many verses, then probably the 4th century would spike up quite a bit, because we have so much extensive evidence from the 4th century. But by and large, the shape of the curve would not differ that much. It's sort of interesting. Many fragments from the 6th century, and then it seems to be petering out a little bit to the 7th century, 8th century. And if I would show you further to the 9th century and onwards, it would go off the scale immediately. So then we're talking about hundreds of them. What happened here? Well, this is a little bit the story of the Greek church, of the Greek-speaking church. Because it was, at the beginning, when the Roman Empire was still there, it was under sort of persecution, or at least it was not state religion. So numbers were slightly suppressed in the second, third century. But then in the 4th century, when Christianity becomes state religion, there is that freedom to invest resources in some of the big manuscripts. So Codex Sinaiticus, Codex Vaticanus, the ones we saw a moment ago. And that goes on into the 5th century. 6th century, we still see the after effect of it, but the manuscripts we have from this time are no longer complete New Testaments. They are mainly or gospel books, or Acts and the letters, or just Revelation. A scribal culture had developed in which not the whole of the New Testament became very important, but the individual parts of it. But what's happening as well, large parts of the Middle East are conquered by Islam. And the area of the Greek-speaking church gets less and less, and that's almost reflected in the manuscripts as well. Now, what happened after this, and then we're properly in the Middle Ages, they changed script from a sort of capital script, they went to a running minuscule script, and from that time on, just many manuscripts have been preserved. The manuscripts produced at this time were probably erased and rewritten, etc., because they were still fairly recent on parchment, but the script was old-fashioned, and you don't want to read old-fashioned scripts, so you erase them and rewrote them. So that is the story of the first sort of 600-700 years of manuscripts in numbers. But of course, I'm only showing Greek manuscripts here. We have Coptic manuscripts. Coptic is the language spoken in Egypt, and what was really sort of a language which we quite some material. We have Latin. Latin was from the rich Western Roman Empire, and the West was considerably wealthier than the East. And there we find a long tradition of complete New Testaments. So while in Greek it's only in the sort of 4th and 5th century, in the Latin it continues with big New Testaments, big Bibles, and numbers in the 10,000, I believe, sort of partial or complete. We have Syriac. Syriac is that sort of script. It's almost impossible to read and has a couple of different types of letter. Pete Williams knows a little bit about Syriac, I believe. And lots of material there. So the amount of evidence is quite extensive. Now, there's a wealth of material available, and they all give us the same message of the New Testament. They give all the same works. They give us the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. They give us the letters. They give us Revelation. But there are details in how they were, differences in the details how they word the text. The wording of the text is different. But everyone would recognize instinctively and practically that we are talking about the same text. When you take a children's Bible nowadays and you put it next to a normal sort of Bible, you would probably say, hey, they tell the same stories, but it is not the same text anymore. Why is that? Because every sentence, every paragraph is just different. The order is completely messed up. Most of the details have changed, or sometimes you find extraordinary details in your children's Bible. There are too many differences to say, hey, this is the same text. When it comes to all the Greek ones, it is the same text, though there are differences in wording. I will be happy to preach from any of those Greek New Testaments, regardless of how they word the text. But we can do some very detailed study. I mean, here we have all those medieval manuscripts. There are just too many of them to read them all. But with those extensive material, you can do fun things. At one stage in my life, I started to count spelling variants in Codex Sinaiticus. You need to do something productive. And you can make sort of very impressive looking tables out of it. And these are the spelling differences per page in one manuscript. And I knew that there were three different scribes at work here. And just by looking at the table of spelling differences, I could see where the three scribes were working. The first one did the first bit up to here, and the second one from here to the end. Sort of equal number of spelling differences. The third one did four pages. These two, this one, and that one. The third one knew how to spell. Hardly any differences. And it's not just sort of spelling in what is good. He is also a very good copyist. I assume it is a he, just for the sake of the argument here. We know about female copyists, actually, from those days. And it is interesting that sort of accuracy in spelling is actually an indication of accuracy in copying, or avoidance of blunders. That's the same true with modern stuff. I'm a teacher, and if I get an essay where there are lots of spelling errors in, it is normally a sign that the contents of those essays are a little bit garbled as well. I mean, attention to one indicates attention to something else as well. Now, what do we learn from all this? Well, one of the things is that if we have a good manuscript of the Gospels and another manuscript with an almost identical text, but it is clear because of the errors that this one cannot be a copy of that one. This one 3rd century, this one 4th century, very identical. So with a little bit of genealogy, triangulation, you can go at least a generation or a couple of generations further back in time. So that is one of the ways how you can sort of sift out errors and go back further in time. But the other thing is, we learn about particular errors. What is copying exactly? Well, copying is quite an involved business. You start with reading the source text. Reading is a tricky business. It is actually very difficult to read something correctly, especially when you expect something else. How often haven't we seen sort of a van passing by with some advertising slogan and we misread it completely? And then we have to look another, oh no, that's what it says. And sometimes those misreadings will tell us a little bit about the things we find important or are thinking about. Now, it's a little bit of Freud involved probably as well here. Then, for a moment, we have to keep that text in mind. Now, how do we keep that in mind? If you have to know a telephone number, you looked it up in your contacts, and then you have to sort of remember it before you dial it, you repeat it internally. It's called the phonological loop. So 243821, 243821. You keep on pronouncing it. That is where a lot of the spelling errors come into play. because you remember it phonologically. Then you actually dictate the words to yourself. In the beginning. That's another thing where you get sort of auto-dictation errors. And finally, there is the action of the hand, because you have to write that stuff. I'm glad that most of us can think quicker than can write. But that means that your hand is constantly playing catch-up with what you're thinking. So easy to skip then. So that is the sort of rough copying process. Now, there are typical errors that come in. One of them is a jump from the same to the same. You see a bit of text, you write, you go back, and okay, you knew that you were saying sort of last thing you wrote was, and Jesus said. You go back to the text, and you see the words, and Jesus said. And you start copying from there. In the meantime, you hadn't realized that you skipped the whole section. That thing you see happening all the time. The other thing is, you insert text that you think should be there. Here is Mark 9. Now, what do we have in the modern Bibles? 42, 43, 45. Ooh, what's there? Defect Bible. 46. I was 46. 46 gone. Well, 47. And the rest is fine. What's happening here, as the footnote says, is some manuscript add verses 44 and 46, which are identical with verse 48. So that we have hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. And that one has jumped forward. Why? Because here we have the words hell, the unquenchable fire, and the scribe knew that these words were somewhere in play, so inserts them earlier. Probably thinking, hey, our manuscript has left out something. And the same happens the second time again, thrown into hell, where the worm does not die and the fire is not quenched. So subsequent copies went for the fuller text, because that is the text they had in front of them, rather than the correct text, where these words occur only once. Influence of liturgy. We talked a bit about liturgical text. From the 5th century onwards, we see something called the Byzantine text, which is very much the text used in the liturgy in the Greek Orthodox Church. This is the start of a lectionary reading, Romans 10:1. It happens to be start of a chapter as well. Brothers, my heart, desire, and prayer to God for them is that they may be saved. If you have this as a start of a lectionary, your whole church congregation will be wondering, who are the them here? So what happens in the liturgical text? Brothers and sisters, my heart desire for the Israelites to be saved. The reference is filled in so that it neatly fits the start of a lectionary reading and everyone knows what we're talking about. The interesting bit is, in modern Bible translation, that happens as well. So this text is actually the translation of the NIV, where they have done the same as many Greek manuscripts, just to fill in the references so that everyone knows what we're talking about. Some examples of the older and the later text. Jesus answered, it's written, man shall not live on bread alone. What does the ecclesiastical text have? We find it in the King James version. They fill out the rest of the citation, but by every word of God. Because that's how it's written in Matthew. So when we're copying it in Luke, we fill out the complete thing. Next verse, devil took him up, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time, taking him up into a high mountain. Again, you can almost see where it comes from the parallel. And that goes on and on. This is an interesting one. Jesus answered and said unto him, get thee behind me, Satan. Where does the scribe get this one from? Well, this is what Jesus tells Peter. When Peter sort of tries to prevent Jesus from going into suffering and going. And of course, that is the sort of thing you would expect Jesus to say to Satan himself. So there, these words have crept in. And there are many other examples too. Right, we will leave this bit. But not this bit. So, how do we explain all this within our churches, within our ministry? The first thing is this. It is not a simple issue. It is a complex issue. And if you want to reduce it for apologetic purposes to a one-liner, you are bound to do injustice to the truth. Some things are too complex to reduce to a single one-liner. Let's face it, God did not do something spectacularly different in the preservation of his word than he did in the cause of the preservation of the church. God did not do a special miracle for the Bible, which he did not do for all the other things that are happening right now. It is not that God has a special way or a certain way of dealing with the church nowadays on a year-to-year basis, where there are great signs of his preservation and his salvation, etc. But in the end, it is the rough and tumble of daily life. That happens with the preservation of Scripture as well. The second, there is the issue of older versus later. Older manuscripts tend to have a better text than later manuscripts. And that's an important one, because the whole Textus Receptus authorized version in English, all the translations that were made in the 17th century are subject to that. And finally, a single textual variant has only limited effect. A single textual variant will affect the exegesis of a sentence. It will rarely affect our understanding of a paragraph. And it never affects the understanding of a chapter, because language is dense enough that it corrects the individual errors. In God's grace, he gave us abundant evidence for the text. And I'm completely sure that we can rely on Scripture as we have it in our hands nowadays. Thank you.